Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this week's W3C CCG meeting. Today, we're excited to have Neil John, to talk about the DHS, Department of Homeland Security's technical implementation requirements for decentralized identity. But before we get to the main agenda, just want to quickly go through some administrative items. First of all, just a quick reminder about the code of ethics and professional conduct. Just want to make sure that we have respectful and constructive conversations. Second, a quick note on the intellectual property. Anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributions to any CCG work items must be the member of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. So if you don't have a W3C account or have questions about that, please reach out to any of the co-chairs. These calls are automatically recorded and transcribed. We will publish the transcription, the audio recording, and the video recording in the next few days. We use GG Chat to queue the speakers during the call, so you can type in Q+ to add yourself to the queue or Q- to remove. Just wanted to take a quick moment for the introductions and reintroduction. So if you're new to the community, or you haven't been active and want to re-engage, just feel free to unmute and introduce yourself.
I'll go first. Hey all, I'm Aryan. I work with SpurseID and keen to learn more about the SVIP stuff and happy to engage with you all.
Great, welcome.
Hi all, my name is Wes. I'm a software engineer at Digital Bazaar and looking forward to working with you all.
Welcome, Wes. Anyone else? A lot of familiar faces and also new ones, so don't be shy. All right. Any announcements or reminders? So if you have some... Great. On you, please.
Yeah. Hey, everyone. Thanks, Harrison. A couple of document publications that folks should be aware of. We had three documents move forward on the standards track last week and the week before. The first one is the verifiable credentials overview. So there's now a verifiable credentials overview document, which is an introduction to all of the specifications in the W3C verifiable credentials space. It's meant to be an entry point and give people kind of a lay of the land on all the different specifications that we're moving forward. So that is now a work item in the verifiable credential working group. The next announcement is Bitstring status list is now a candidate recommendation. So this basically means we are feature frozen with Bitstring status list. It is published. We are looking for implementers at this point, of which there are already enough implementers. We're doing test suite stuff like that. But that's another big kind of move forward. And then finally, there is a new document called the controller document, a new specification called controller document. A decentralized identifier document is a type of controller document. And now there's a generalized specification for that the VCWG is publishing. That is meant to go on to the global standards track as well. So lots of stuff happening. Just making sure this group is aware of those pieces of progress. That's it.
Thank you, Manu. Any other announcements or reminders? So next week we'll have Greg to talk about updates to BBS for VC and JSON LD. And the week after that, we'll have Marianne to talk about their YID campaign. So that's a not a technical talk. It's talking about more on the social impact side of things. So a lot of interesting topics coming up. All right, any updates to the work items? Last calls for introductions, reintroductions, announcements, or work item updates. So I know, Will, our culture has been reaching out to different folks in regards to updates on the work item, so we'll have more to report later. All right, so let's get to the main agenda. Again, very excited to have Anil here. Anil already has sent out the presentation in advance to the public list, so you can just open it up and then follow along. All right, Anil, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Harrison. I'm going to share and hope that things work as expected. Give me just 1 second. All right. And hopefully you are seeing my screen.
Yes.
Perfect.
Looks good.
All right. First of all, thank you all very much for the opportunity to share details about our technical implementation requirements. Good morning, good evening, good night, or whatever time zone that you're in. As Harrison mentioned, my name is Anil John. I'm a technical director with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. And the requirements that that I'm going to go over are, you know, the requirements that we have chosen for implementing our decentralized identity capabilities that meet our operational needs, in particular, the operational needs of two of the oldest parts of the U.S. government, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, that is in the business of issuing digital credentials that are relevant to those two things, Citizenship and Immigration Services, think permanent resident card, employment authorization document, certificates of naturalization and citizenship and the like, and U.S. Customs and Border Protection, which is in the business of issuing credentials that are related to cross-border trade and travel. So think about all the trade documents that are needed to be presented to a U.S. Customs in order to bring goods into the country and to expedite arrival into the country, like our CT Path credentials. For those who are familiar with that piece of it, that's like trusted trader credentials. There are also credentials from the people's side of U.S. Customs and Border Protection that you may be familiar with, like our global entry credentials, our Nexus and Sentry credentials, and the like. And last but not least, these requirements are also, coming from another organizations within DHS, DHS Privacy Office, which basically was the first privacy office that was stood up as part of statute within the U.S. government itself. So you're going to hear about some of the choices that we're making. I also want to be very clear in saying that these are requirements and this is not a profile. And the difference is important because requirements sort of give the outer boundary of what we will not go beyond and the choices that we will be, you know, anchoring our implementation on. These requirements still need to be profiled to ensure interoperability. So that is important to consider as well. As we are going through them, we're trying to balance, you know, a two, high level approaches here. An implementation should be conservative in its sending behavior and liberal in its receiving behavior. Originally published in the discussion section of the TCP spec by John Postel back in the day. It goes by Postel's law. It's also been rebranded as a robustness principle. I think this was a principle that was really, really important to ensure what became the internet, a philosophy that was very, very important in order to ensure, you know, broad availability and, implementations flourished more than anything else. So that is something that is important to us. And we're trying to balance that as a public institution with the philosophy of and, not or. And what we mean by that is we do not have the luxury of pivoting into serving, you know, a very small segment of the population. We need to serve everybody as a public institution, which means that there are different communities who've made different choices in how they will implement them. And we as an institution and an organization that need to support a global touchpoint need to be able to open the aperture in the choices that we're making as well. So you will see that as you are going through this more than anything else. As I'm going through these requirements, it's also important to note that there are, you know, two types of, you know, credentials, of a lack of a better word, that we are involved in because of the business drivers for our organization. There are the credentials that are credentials for people. You know, we are calling them obviously personal credentials, but we are also dealing with, you know, cross-border trade and supply chain and organizational credentials, because we are applying the same set of technologies to that particular domain as well. So we have, you know, supply chain credentials as well. The supply chain credentials are typically, you know, shared within the context of online transactions, but the personal credentials obviously have both a in-person and an online presentation as well. So, wanted to make sure that you understood the different, you know, specific contexts that we are dealing with in the choices that we're making here. So, speaking to personal credentials, we are grounded in a set of implementation principles when it comes to personal credentials. We want to ensure that the right to paper is something that is really, really inherent and important. So digital for us will never be a requirement. It is a choice. If somebody wants a digital credential in addition to their paper-based credential, they need to request it and they will get it. But we will be able to engage with them whether they are you know, using a paper-based credential or a digital credential at the same level of fidelity, with the ability to conduct the same level of transactions in any way, shape, or form. We definitely want to implement IDs that do not phone home and provide mechanisms that eliminate back channel interactions between the verifier and the issuer without the knowledge of the holder of the credentials themselves. And obviously, you know, supporting non-trackable selective disclosure, to provide, granular control over data that is released, it becomes really, really important for us as well. And, you know, and obviously, you know, providing that, non-correlatable selective disclosure, is critically important. It was a challenge to figure out our way forward on that, but I believe that we have come up with a way that allows us to deploy this technology on a U.S. government network while at the same time meeting our privacy commitments to do so as well. And last but not least, we are very, very, very much interested in ensuring that there exists an ecosystem that is vibrant, interoperable, that has choice in the marketplace of the technologies that you are using and the vendors that you are, you know, sourcing those technologies from, that are based on standards and are tested and interoperable. We've been too often in the past been walked into vendor-specific and proprietary implementation that did not meet the needs of anyone but the vendor that was selling us that technology. We are not interested in going down that path in this journey. And that is also one of our, you know, foundational implementation principles for our personal credentials here as well. Speaking of, in-person usage of personal credentials, we're going a little bit differently than a lot of the conversations that are going on in the ecosystem. To start with, we fundamentally believe that we have a very solid paper-based credential. We spend a significant amount of, time, treasure, and attention to make sure that it is, secure, that it cannot be, replicated, without, a significant amount of effort. I will never say it cannot be replicated because that would be a lie. But at the same time, in the current stage of paper-based credentials, what we call read to verify, it also has the benefit of being an inclusive credential that is globally usable. You do not need a $1,000 mobile phone in order to use that credential. And even more important from a U.S. government perspective, we have no awareness of how and where that credential is used when you are using a physical credential. There is no phone home that is happening. So when we talk about in-person presentations, we need those inclusiveness. We need that global usage. We need that comfort level with the technology for people who do not want to use a technical solution. And we also want that, counter-tracking, counter-surveillance capability that is built into a physical credentials to persist in whatever changes or updates that we make to those physical credentials. And the changes that we are making to those physical credentials in order to enable digital verification of physical credentials enable just that. It doesn't change that inclusiveness aspect. It doesn't change the no phone home properties. What we're doing here, as we're moving from a read to verify to a scan to verify with a 2D barcode, is, and I'll get into the details of that in the next slide, is providing that same capability in the physical credential, that, you currently have, same capabilities for digital verification without the, the correlatability or the non-tracking piece that we have with our current physical credentials themselves. In the long term, we hope to move to a tap to verify capability whereby the same properties persist, but you basically have a much more streamlined and a local digital verification using NFC that also routes around perhaps the constraints on the usage of NFC radios in mobile devices and the like. So when we talk about scan to verify, what does that mean? It's very simple, actually, conceptually. The input to creating a digitally signed barcode, a digitally signed credential is actually the MRZ on the back of this card. The 2D barcode payload is the MRZ, or for those like me who are raised with the King's English, MRZ. That is the input. In addition to the decentralized identifier that basically provides a mechanism to retrieve the public key that can be used to verify and validate the credential. That basically goes into a process that generates a CBOR LD mechanism, aka we call it a dehydrated verifiable credential that can be represented in a 2D barcode. It continues to, provide that inclusive global usage without the need for a mobile device. We continue to have no awareness of where that credential is used. You have the ability to, retrieve and cache the public key that can be used to verify that digital signature, so that you don't even have to make a network hop in order to locally verify that digital signature, on the physical credential itself. This is our pathway for in the near term to midterm for in-person presentation of our credentials. Now, does that mean that we will not go down the path of providing an in-person presentation for our digital credentials? Absolutely, we will, but we want to get that right and not fast. We want to work out the privacy concerns around them. We want to work out the openness and the ability to use the technology in a manner that is not constrained by platforms and the like to be worked out. So we are comfortable with this approach for our physical credentials more than anything else. And obviously, one thing that we are obviously using here, as I mentioned earlier, is in addition to the verifiable credentials data model as a credential representation standard, we are actually using the decentralized identifier identifies, in particular, did web as a mechanism for us to distribute the public keys that are associated with us as an organization. I want to be very clear. Did web, in our usage, only identifies the issuers of the credential, aka U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service and U.S. Citizenship and U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Web is absolutely not used as an identifier for people, because that would be highly correlatable. And that is not a path to success. So we use DidWeb as a mechanism to distribute, keys at scale. And that is important to us, both for the physical credentials and obviously for our, online usage here as well. For our online usage here, obviously we are using Verifiable Credentials Data Model and W3C, DIDs as well, as the core standards. I think it is very important to sort of understand some of the rationale for why we, beyond our participation here, in the W3C, on why we, what we've chosen and anchored our standards on the W3C standards themselves. And I put something into the chat right now. It was a presentation that was given by, Daniel Applequist, who is a member of the W3C Technical Architecture Group, last month at the Open Source Summit in Seattle. He talked about the horizontal reviews that are being done as part of any standardization process at W3C that take into account internationalization, security, privacy, and a variety of other aspects on the technical architecture side as well. In the current state of technology, it is not just important to just have code that works and, some consensus that this is really good. We are at the stage of technology where it is really, really important that, standards creators and standards implementers need to understand the consequences of the standards, and the choices that can be made using those standards. And the horizontal reviews and the wide reviews that W3C provides, across, the domains is critical in ensuring that the standards themselves, bake in, those type of aspects into what is implementable. That tends to be sometimes, frustrating to, technical folks. But as a technologist who works for a, public sector entity, there is absolutely a level of comfort in having those, broad independent reviews and people, poking under the covers on exactly what the impact of a particular standards and technology are, before, people like us implement that. So, that is, if you haven't seen Daniel's presentation or if you've not, if you do not know about the horizontal reviews that W3C, puts every standards through, please do take a look at the YouTube recording of his presentation there. So, getting into the details here, as I mentioned, these are requirements. Requirements are not profiles. There is still work to be done in order to profile these standards for implementation. But I wanted to, separate what you're going to be seeing into, three buckets. What are the expectations of a personal credential issuer implemented by DHS? What are the expectations of a personal credential verifier that is implemented by DHS? What are the, and what are the implications of a digital wallet that is implemented by DHS? And sort of go down deep into them. There is overlap between them, but I also want to be very, very clear that this was, all of these are important to us. So I we definitely, clarified each of them rather than sort of getting them lost, in a wholesome meddle there, right? The, conventions that we're using are, you know, coming from ISO. If you're, you know, you are seeing, you're going to be seeing requirements with the shall and shall not recommendations, you know, using should and should not and permission may and may not and possibility as you see fit. So moving on, we start with accessibility and openness when it comes to our implementation for digital credentials. There is only one shall not you will see in this document, and that is that first one. A DHS issuer shall not implement capabilities that enable tracking of holder credential use, full stop. We think, if you are a public institution, this tends to be something that is often brought up, and we wanted to make sure that the choices and the technologies that we are using and implementing, you know, down to the choices that we make at the implementation level, bake in, you know, that particular requirement here. Accessibility is really, really important. So for us, the ability to use, web content, accessibility guidelines, which is actually the foundation on which the, Section 508 of the U.S. Rehab Act is based on, needs to be incorporated into our issuer, wallet, and verifier implementations as well. We lean into and prioritize open, royalty-free, freely available, standards and specification that can be implemented by a one-person shop all the way to a state-level actor as the thing that we will always choose first. We require that the wallet, we require that if you are an issuer, the issuer needs to give the holder the ability to choose the digital wallet of their choice. We support our digital wallets that are implemented using both web platform technologies as well as native platform technologies as well. When it comes to the platform and software security piece of it, we require the use of cryptographic modules that have been validated by the CMVP program, which, for those of you who, if you're in the cryptographic space, you know what that is, but it's a joint program that is run by US and Canada, that validates cryptographic modules that can be used within government networks. And obviously, we need those cryptographic key storage mechanisms to be FIPS 140 compliant. And for our implementations, right, for the verifiers, issuers, and wallets, it is really, really important that we have a sense of and a clear idea of the components that go into those products themselves. So a software bill of material that clearly shares information on the subcomponents that go into the building of an issuer, a verifier, and a wallet that we implement is critically important, because when vulnerabilities come up, when problems come up, we want to know if any of the components of the software that we're running are impacted, and we want to make sure that we are able to mitigate them. So SBOMs are really, really important. This actually is something that is driven, and there is common agreement both across the public sector and the private sector that software bill of materials and visibility into supply chain of the software itself is critically important. So this is something that is a requirement for us as well. Now we get into some of the details of the credential formats and the digital signatures that we have, chosen as our implementation requirement. We'll start with the first one when it comes to credential format. We are choosing W3C, Verifiable Credentials Data Model, that is using JSON-LD Compacted Document Form. This is version 2.0 of the standard. As you know, version 1.0 came out in, 2018 or so. It was then updated to version 1.1 in around 2022, and we are, one step removed from the global standardization of version 2.0 for BCDM. This is a standard that has, gone through a significant amount of iterations and input, and we are comfortable with choosing them as that our foundational model. Before we get into the other piece of it, I wanted to speak a little bit on this. I've often found that within our community, there is a little bit of hand waving going on over the choice between and the value add of the variety of different data models that are there. And in fact, as somebody who is a reader of meeting minutes from way back in the Verifiable Credentials Working Group itself, I have been semi-amused to note that whenever somebody brings up a desire to put into the standard itself, what is the value of the underlying data format itself? You know, that tends to be downplayed, and it seems to die the death of a thousand cuts more than anything else. So I wanted to basically articulate why we are choosing VCDM, verifiable W3C, verifiable credentials data model 2.0, as the core, you know, credential data format for our credential, issuance more than anything else. It starts with something very simple. A lot of people in the identity world come to identity from the authentication side of the house. But at the end of the road, authentication is only one piece of the identity equation. Authentication is, needed, but it's not sufficient in order to gain access or to do a business process. For that, you actually need a lot of additional information in order to be conveyed from one party to the other, from a credential to a verifier in order to make those type of decisions. It need to be combined with other types of information in order to actually make decisions. So the ability to represent not just data, but information, so that common meaning is understood on both ends of the wire is pretty critically important. And that semantic understanding is possible because of the data model of the W3C VCDM. And it also brings another benefit here, the ability to publish that information to the public, whether it is as a context or whether it is as human readable information, such that there is very clear understanding of what terms are in a credential, what terms are acceptable to an organization becomes very, very important. The term publish and discover is not mine. I actually completely and totally stole that from a wonderful person by the name of Nancy Norris, who works for the government of British Columbia, who's doing some fabulous work in cross-border trade for the government of British Columbia in Canada. And she used that term with me one time when speaking to Jason LD, and I thought that was so appropriate. So the ability to publish and describe information becomes very, very possible with VCDM. The ability to provide built-in namespaces and versioning using context is a clear a capability for W3C VCDM. There's a whole bunch of other people and other credential types that are, that need to, reinvent the wheels, like in doing, namespaces and versioning using OIDs and variety of other, namespacing mechanism more than anything else. This is built in and comes for the ride with, W3C VCDM. Multi-language support. I think a clear example of that, California DMV published the OpenCred platform. They actually showed an example of multi-language capabilities that are possible when it comes to, the use of VCDM. So I'd urge you to look at that. As you well know, the verifiable credential data model supports multiple signature types. You actually have, enveloping signature types using, Jose and Cose, and you also have embedded signature types using data integrity proofs as well. We actually end up using both, but for different use cases. So the ability to sort of use them flexibility is a significant benefit to what VCDM brings to the table. The ability to process content. If you are comfortable with JSON LD APIs, go to town. If you're not, don't. You have the ability to use, you know, standard JSON APIs, provided that you are very, very, you know, mindful about the actual, you know, structure of the credential itself as written in the VCDM spec itself. And last but not least, an example of what I mean by dehydrated binary barcodes is our example of using, you know, CBORLD, a dehydrated version of verifiable credentials that can be resident on a physical credentials. All of this with the same standard, the same specification, incredible flexibility, incredible amount of power, and the ability to not come up with a new standard for every other type of credential and new data model for different types of credentials is just amazing and is one of the reasons that we've chosen VCDM as the core standard for us. We are using as a signature format data integrity proofs for personal credentials because it solves and addresses something very, very important to us, which is as a U.S. government entity, we require that the cryptography that is deployed on our network needs to be FIPS compliant. But we also are leaning forward to ensure that we are also providing privacy capabilities like selective disclosure that cannot be correlated on signatures and the like. Those at the present tend to be, could be considered irreconcilable, but we found a way to reconcile them by using proof sets in data integrity proofs. And what I mean by that is the ability to basically apply multiple proofs, one that is using FIPS compliant cryptographic primitives, the other one that is using a non-correlatable cryptographic primitives like BBS plus in order to sign the document itself. The fascinating thing is that we, you know, we had an extensive conversation with our national technical authority on this one. And, it was discovered that this is up to and including CMVP validation. Dual signatures, as NIST calls them, are fully acceptable. In fact, if you take a cryptographic module that contains both a FIPS compliant cryptographic primitive as well as a, for example, a BBS cryptographic primitive through the CMVP program, you will notice that the CMVP program will actually is allowed to list the non-FIPS compliant cryptography on the FIPS validation certificate below the line for one particular reason, to showcase that it doesn't invalidate the CMVP, you know, certification itself. So a lot more details. Take a look at the background. I actually have a provided to the relevant authoritative references from NIST, on the background on the slides that have been shared with you. So take a look at it. So we are using that capability, in order to provide both non-correlatable signatures and FIPS compliant signatures so that we are able to meet both our security and our privacy commitments in the credentialing that we are doing. And as I mentioned earlier, we are using and implementing a W3C DIT standard. Before I come back to BitString status list, one change that I will note here, because it is a recommendation in the DIT standard. We actually require that the DIT document be digitally signed to ensure its integrity and its provenance. But other than that, we are using the DIT standards, in particular DIT Web, as a mechanism to identify us as an organization and to distribute our public keys that can be used to, you know, review and validate our credentials. We are using W3C BitString status list for credential status checks. I will stress again and again, requirements and not a profile. If you know anything about the BitString status list, you know that there are multiple ways of representing how, you know, credentials that can be, that can only be revoked, and credentials that can be revoked and suspended. How do you represent them? There are multiple ways of doing them, so profiling is needed. Implementations matter, because when you implement a BitString status list as a verifier, as an issuer, which we are, if somebody is calling in to check the status of the credentials, we actually do not know about whose credential is being checked. That's one measure of privacy and that is provided. But implementations matter in order to ensure that we don't even have any awareness of who is calling us. You need to make sure that the verifier implements their call through implementing something like, you know, oblivious HTTP, so that the identity of the verifier is also hidden from the issuer. So the choices that we make in these implementations still need to be worked out. And that is something that we are, you know, walking through very, very carefully, you know, here as well. We've worked out in the open with the CCG, with this group, a citizenship vocabulary that is going to be used in order to represent the credentials that we're using. And that is something that is a requirement for us as well. We are also considering, something else here as well. We believe that it is important if you're an organization that is an issuer, that you stand behind your identifier, you stand behind the credentials that you issue, so that when somebody says that, hey, did web uscis.gov means USCIS itself, USCIS, we want to make sure that there is, there is a mechanism that allows a counterparty to actually, you know, verify that domain and that identifier actually belong to a legitimate US government entity. You can read faster than I can. I also put into the chat one of the things that we are looking at, high assurance DIDs with DNS. In general, at a very high level, I mentioned earlier that you are signing the DID document. Now, in order to validate the DID document, you obviously need a public certificate. This high assurance DID with DNS provides a mechanism whereby you can basically put that public certificate that signed the DID document in the TLSA record of a domain. So like uscis.gov, so that you have the ability to ensure that a legitimate .gov domain is indeed the authoritative owner of that identifier that is then used to basically, you know, issue those credentials itself. Again, take a look at the high assurance DID with DNS piece that I put in the chat. It is something that we are seriously considering, primarily because it doesn't require any new standards or capabilities. You have the ability to use existing, DID technologies as well as DNS technologies to actually, get to the capabilities that we're talking about here as well. And let's see. Issuance protocols. This is definitely something that we are going to be testing very carefully. Let's start with the basics here. We intend to support multiple issuance protocols, full stop, because we have a broad set of communities that we need to serve. The choices before us tend to be on the issuance side, VCA API from W3C CCG and OIDs for VCI, OID4 for VCI from the Digital Credential Protocol group at OIDF. Our choices when this moves from TBD to this is a choice is contingent upon the issuance protocol actually supporting the credential format and the digital signature mechanisms that we've just talked about. We're not big believers and let's put it on paper or let's have a t-shirt or anything like that to say that we support it. We are going to test. We are going to verify. And only after we are confident that our credentials, our security formats, and the choices that ensure privacy for our customers and security for our customers are supported by those issuance protocols, will we basically move from a TBD to an actual choices between them. But as you note here, this is something that the two choices that we are actively evaluating are those two that you see here. So moving on to the credential verifier piece, I think a whole lot of this is, you know, is duplicative. I will just call out the things that are, you know, different more than anything else. The only thing that I will see here is the last statement on the verifier may implement additional credential data formats and associated proof mechanisms. We require the things that we are talking about there for credential formats and digital signatures. We reserve the right to, you know, validate and verify additional credential formats downstream. We don't have any at this point in time, but this is, we are leaving open that possibility. And particularly for, you know, there are companies that are implementing these capabilities under contract to us. We wanted to make sure that they have the flexibility based on their, you know, customer needs and things like that to support not just our requirements, but also the requirements of others as well. That is why that language is there. Only difference here on the metadata is that obviously this is the reverse. If you're going to sign the DID document, you better verify the digital signature on the DID document there as well. And you've seen this before. On the exchange protocol side, the same caveats as before with one addition here. We are actively tracking the digital credentials API work in the W3C WSIG, which I believe is potentially moving into the Federated Identity Working Group itself. I think the feedback that the W3C staff collected from the community on what that work needs to encompass is spot on, and we support them. So we are actually tracking that as well. So for the presentation piece, that is important. We also hope that it will also include an issuance piece as well. So if that becomes real, it'll also be a choice for our issuance protocol as well. On the wallet side, same here, nothing new that you will not see, specific details around how you sort of present the credentials and things like that. But as far as the credential formats and digital signatures, you absolutely, you're going to see consistency here. And obviously in a wallet, we are going through the process, and we will go through the process on figuring out, you know, what is an acceptable wallet? I don't think the community has done enough work to understand the security, privacy, and interoperability criteria that one can use in order to judge the quote-unquote goodness of a wallet. So what that basically means is, in addition to our own wallet that we would have, we fully anticipate the ability to issue credentials into external wallet that we can all agree on a common baseline of security, privacy, and interoperability. Those wallets might actually support credential types that are beyond what we have outlined as our requirements, and that is perfectly fine. So that last statement is very much focused on that. Issuance protocol and the exchange protocol piece is, you know, definitely the same. Normative references for personal credentials, but I also wanted to basically touch on our supply chain and organizational credentials piece as well. You will notice that when it comes to the credential format and digital signatures, we actually have the same credential format, JSON-LD, compacted data form of W3C VC data model. But we are using a different signature format. We are actually using, you know, W3C, securing W3C VCs with Jose and Cose specification, and back using Jose as the digital signature mechanism. It is very simple for why we are doing it. On the trade side, we do not have a non-correlatability requirement, and we do not have a requirement to simultaneously provide, you know, FIPS compliant and non-correlatable signature. If you know anything about the supply chain, it is entirely about gaining deep visibility into the supply chain of goods that are moving into the U.S. We want to, you know, go as far back to the origin of goods in order to understand whether these goods were created using forced labor, these were transshipped to other entities in order to import them into the U.S. So, correlatability is something that happens within the context of supply chain credentials and organizational credentials. So we do not have a non-correlatability piece within the supply chain piece. We do not have a selective disclosure requirement currently within the trade piece as well. So that is the reason that we've chosen the other signature format for here. And separately, you know, we are also, again, we're using the BitString status list as the revocation mechanism, and we're using trace vocabulary as a mechanism for sharing our vocabulary with the public and what we expect. The actual protocols are actually a variation on an OAuth-based protocol that was defined under the W3C called the Trace API. Links are in the normative guidance here. So that is something obviously fits naturally with the organization to organization credential flows for supply chain credentials. So I know that I've gone through very similar variation on this one as well. I know that I've gone very fast through all of them, and I wanted to stop there just to at least, you know, take any questions that you might have on the line.
Questions for Neil?
Out of a question about CBRLD specifically. So a while ago, I made an implementation of CBRLD, but as far as I remember, there is no support for like versioning of the compression dictionary. Does that exist today? Because I was trying to find like an up-to-date spec, but I end up on a page that doesn't exist anymore of what was supposed to be a rough spec. So could you give an update of where CBRLD is today?
For sure. And in fact, I actually will punt that to Minus Forney, who's waiting on the line. I'm sure that who can speak to that much better than eloquently than I can.
thanks, Anil. I don't know about eloquently. So Aaron, the specification was moved into the JSON-LD community group. So it's been adopted. That's why the old link you're using no longer works. There is a plan to take its standards track in the next iteration of the JSON-LD or linked data community group. And one of the things that we're looking at is kind of the versioning of the compression dictionaries and things of that nature. Right now, you kind of need to understand, you know, what type of credential you're going to be reading, before you pull it in. So all that to say, happy to engage with you more on the JSON-L, in the JSON-LD group or in the upcoming working group, help with implementations. I will readily admit that spec is dragging behind the other ones just because there's so much other work, around, the current set of work. In any case, yes, happy to sync offline, on that.
Sure. Thanks.
All right, Phil, you're next in the queue.
Yes. Anil, thank you for the presentation. I'm just wondering, when you reference the high assurance did with DNS, it sounds almost like it is an interim or at least an alternative for a repository of issuers and verifiers approach that takes advantage of DNS for that function in at least a limited form. Is that a fair interpretation?
I don't look at it that way. So one of the things that is important to understand, at least about the, you know, what we call, you know, .gov binding here, right, is that it's important to understand that the .gov top level domain is actually managed by the U.S. government. In fact, it's actually managed by a part of DHS CISA, and it's only available to, you know, U.S. government entities, whether it is federal, state, local, tribal, or territorial. And there is a very stringent process whereby an entity will be provisioned a .gov domain, albeit freely. We wanted to basically leverage that to ensure that if you are interacting with a U.S. government entity, you had full confidence that entity was a legitimate U.S. government organization. So, so the ability to provide a link, cryptographic link between the DID web and the .gov domain that allowed for that verification to happen is really, really valuable for us. So I'll stop there, Phil. I know that if you read the spec itself, and I would recommend that you speak to the editors, whether it is, you know, Tim Boma or the folks from CIRA, which is a Canadian registrar, as well as Mateus from Northern Bloc. It can be, you know, used with any domain, so there is broad applicability, but we want to sort of leverage the real estate that we have access to in order to ensure that we showed the binding of ourselves as a legitimate government entity.
Thank you.
Dimitri.
Thanks. And thanks again, Anil. This is fantastic as usual. I was really happy to hear you mention that you'll be signing the DID web DID document. So that's always good. And I'm hoping you're keeping an eye on some of the DID web enhancement proposals like trusted DID web method, which basically add the signature to DID document and then add a signed log of key rotation events. That's it.
I am absolutely keeping track of it. I love the work that the government of British Columbia recently did on this one. And obviously, you know, have you noticed there's a theme here? This work came out of the Canadians as well. I'm really glad of the work and keeping track of it. You know, anything that sort of, you know, gives high assurances to the decentralized identity DIDs is a good thing in my mind. So definitely keeping track of that.
Stefan.
Yeah, hello. Thank you, Anil. Great presentation. Good to hear about all this. My question, I actually have two questions. The first one is, what's the target issuer sort of community or population for it? Is it just U.S. federal governments or is it anybody?
The requirements that I spoke about are the requirements of the entities that issue cross-border trade and cross-border, you know, travel within the U.S. government, which tends to be U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services and U.S. Citizenship, U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Those are the issuers of those credentials. Those credentials in general are used broadly. Obviously, if you are moving any goods into the U.S., you are going to be interacting with U.S. Customs and using these credentials. So that's public sector, private sector, you know, globally. Our digital immigration credentials are used for everything from KYC to showing, you know, residency and employment eligibility in order to apply for a job. So the usage of the credentials tend to be, you know, both much broader, but the issuers are, we are the issuers.
Yep, makes sense. The second question is, so I understand then there will be parallel signatures for the proofs, one being, you know, FIPS compliant, but therefore traceable, and one being BDS or style like that, therefore not traceable. Is there or should there perhaps be something that would almost make it a requirement for verifiers to use the non-trackable proofs, you know, rather than them sort of forcing the trackable one on users?
This is where Anil John, the technologist who works for a U.S. government entity, becomes very, very careful, because you just crossed into the line of regulation and law. And I prefer not to opine on that. What I will note is for our verifier, you will notice a couple of specific languages here that I'm showing here. We note that in general, when a negotiation happens between a digital wallet and a verifier on which, you know, cryptographic, you know, signing scheme in order to use, in order to share information, we recommend that the verifier should prioritize the minimal disclosure of data and metadata by the holder when negotiating a mutually acceptable proof. And I will leave it at that. I think I'm sure there are folks from the from the policy side, from the privacy and civil liberty community sides, who can basically probably share more information on what it would take in order for verifiers for that to be binding. We do not have the equivalent regulation, perhaps, that the European Union or other countries have in order to sort of make that binding on a verifier.
Thank you.
Well, thanks. Thanks, everyone, for great questions. And thanks, Anil, for yet another great presentation. If anyone else, due to the time constraints, we won't take any further questions. But if anyone else have questions, feel free to just respond to the public email thread. And obviously, if there's so many questions, I'll try to schedule a follow-up conversation with Anil so that people can have further and continue this discussion. All right. Thanks, Anil. Thanks for jumping on.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. This concludes this week's CCG meeting, and we'll see you next week. Thanks.